Accession number 12708, Mr. R.W. Hawksworth, Reel 18.
Mr. R.W. Hawksworth, Reel 18. Looking back again over your wartime experiences, Mr. Hawksworth, have you any recollections of particular officers who stand out in your mind for one reason or another?
Well, from my early days, I suppose that the outstanding figures in my memory, as far as officers concerned, would be the commanding officers. Who assumed command of the battalion during this brief period of my service. As I remember, our first my first commanding officer was Lieutenant Colonel Gray Wilson, who would in those old-fashioned days ride at the head of the battalion on a grey horse. One officer in particular who everyone respected intensely and frightened the hell out of everybody was Fitz Fox Davis, who was unfortunately killed at the Battle of Kabutso in a futile effort to create a rearguard action. But Fitz Fox Davis certainly springs to mind. But I think of all the officers I ever met, both in peace and war, I think the one individual that stands out from the rest would be Crackers May, our beloved CO at one time. He was a man's man. He joined with the men in all the games, and certainly at work he got stuck in. He's a very popular figure, and an officer of this calibre does a lot for the morale and good feeling within the battalion. Since that time, of course, we had change of officers frequently due to one thing or another, illness or battle casualty. Most recently, I reckon that the officers I remember best would be the ones who served in Korea, in the Korean War, which placed a great strain on them, especially the younger officers. This was a static war with no means of boredom relief when one was in the line, at any rate. And the platoon commander's job in those days, I consider, was equally difficult to that of the commanding officer or even the brigadier. Michael McBain, one of our platoon commanders, was notably an extremely good platoon commander, and the men would have followed him anywhere. Bill Knottbauer, another one of our platoon commanders, likewise. They were all good chaps. I could mention other names. Should I be able to remember them? However. They're the main figure that I have in the forefront of my mind.
What, in your opinion, were the qualities of a good officer?
Well, I think I might be biased in the respect that I may be speaking as a one-time instructor, and our attitude, of course, was to be in front of the squad or the assembly believe, as far as we were concerned, we were starting from scratch and they knew nothing and we knew it all. That's not necessarily the attitude that a good officer should adopt, certainly from his first introduction to his men. I think a good understanding is one of the highest qualities that an officer should develop if he hasn't already got it. And certainly a sympathetic attitude. There are always certain individuals who need leading a little way more than t'others, and a feeling of family rather than I'm in charge. This attitude certainly was the thing in the Durham right through the war. I experienced anyway. It was not so much a lot of men bossed by a lot of officers, but it was a lot of us with the officers in charge, and more, not so much in charge, but leading.
Were there any officers that you recall who didn't quite make the standard?
I think only on two occasions, and I can't remember the names in any case, for which I'm glad. But only on two occasions, and I think at the at that time, one was in Tobruk, as I remember, and this young gentleman had to be removed for his own benefit and of course that of his men. And the next one, I believe, was in Syria. Some unfortunate incident took place, and once again, it was a junior officer who landed in the mud, and he had to be disciplined and sent elsewhere. But they were the only two isolated incidents in what five or six years that I ever experienced.
The NCOs that you met and worked with over the years, are there any particularly outstanding ones that you felt helped you yourself and the men?
Well, my first impression of non-commissioned officers, of course, would have been my old band sergeant, Sam Foster, who looked after us like a granny, an attitude which still exists in regimental bands. They consider themselves possibly a cut above the rest and stick together like peas in pods or whatever they say. He was my first NCO. The other one who I got to know about the same time was Corporal Tim Scully, who was in charge of our boys section, who'd recently arrived from service on the Northwest Frontier, and it was a source of information. Some of his advice stayed in our minds even when we arrived in North China. All the band NCOs, of course, whose names I can't remember, were well liked and respected. But I think the one that stays closest is my old friend Fishwick, who came in with the Essex reinforcements at Buk after the Capuzzo fiasco, and having instructed me on the weapon training course in Malta and being posted to his section, we became firm friends, a friendship which lasted until I was removed from action having been wounded.
What are the qualities of a good NCO? It is a difficult job. You're in between the men on the one hand and the officers on the other.
Well, it's often been said that the most difficult rank to hold is that of a Lance Corporal. You'd just been elevated to the dizzy height from being a knockabout with your mates, and a certain amount of mickey taking would result. One had to get over this. But eventually, of course, the people forgot about the fact that he had a stripe on the arm, and being well trained, it's funny how it happened, but they eventually realised that what you said you meant, and they jumped and carried out the instruction. The most popular rank, I suppose, would be that of a corporal, because he is told by the platoon sergeant what to do, and in turn gives it to the lance corporal to carry out, and the chain of command is a hard stair to climb, but it's damn good training all the way along. Platoon sergeant, of course, had to get along well with his platoon commander. They were the two people who had, in fact, to look after the platoon family. I reckon that the most difficult task in the battalion would have been that of the platoon commander. He had not only charge of some 30-odd men, but he was responsible not only for the day-to-day discipline, the cleanliness of the accommodation, etc., but he needed to look after the welfare also.
What qualities or lack of qualities did men dislike in an NCO?
Well, the most degrading quality that a non-commissioned officer could ever adopt would be that of bullying. There's a dividing line between a strict disciplinarian, a martinet, and a bullying type. One usually found out, as lots of other people did, that the invariably you found out that the bullying type knew little or nothing about anything and had to adopt an overbearing attitude in order to bluff his way through. Fortunately, these were few and far between.
Amongst the men themselves, there would be the characters of the platoon or the company or whatever. Do any stand out?
Well, we had again, starting in the band, of course, our character in the band would have been our humorous bassoonist, Smurthwaite, who both off duty and on would keep us in fits of laughter from time to time. The mechanical transport section had a character called Jimmy Garnick, who I think I referred to previously. He was a canteen comedian. A genial old chap called Callaghan, of obvious Irish descent, was another regimental or battalion character, more to be found in the canteen than on the square, and knew every corner of the guard room intimately. There were, of course, others, but they're the first few that spring to mind.
In an action situation, in any group of men, obviously, there are those who are eager to get forward or do what they have to do. There must be others who knew it was their duty but weren't so eager. And there must have been an element who you knew would need support to carry out what you had to do. How does one deal with that, particularly in the situation of being a platoon commander, or a platoon NCO?
This is another interesting question, and I can only explain my attitude to this, or my answer as follows. I've told you once already that I was involved in cross-country running, and which entails training a team, running in the team, and more important, running as part of the team. And I would equate that the action of a section in action to be similar to that of a cross-country team. When you run as a team, as everyone knows, you run together, and if necessarily take your time by the slowest person. If you've got a fast person and everybody's capable of keeping up with him, then you run as fast as you can. So if you're in action with a section of men carrying the rifles or machine guns or whatever, care must be taken that one doesn't gallop off ahead and leave the stragglers behind unprotected and on their own, likely to get lost. This is where careful control is exercised, and great care was taken in our infantry training to make sure we observed this at all times.
Did you experience at any time where you had to threaten someone to carry out or to join in a particular activity or action?
It happened to me only once. Shortly after I'd been Land Sergeant, appointed Land Sergeant in Italy, before we moved up to Vanafro, we were in a static situation in a farmyard area when we were detailed to go out that night on a fighting patrol. Some 20 strong. Six of my men and myself were included in this party with men from another company. And one of the necessary items we had to carry were a Mills 36 hand grenade, which in those days carried a 4-second fuse. It was necessary, therefore, late in the afternoon to have the grenade primed in readiness for the operation that night. I issued the necessary orders, and the corporal came along not too long after and informed me that Private Snooks had refused to even touch the grenade. I went immediately along to investigate the matter and found, when asked the necessary questions, that this private soldier had never been instructed on the grenade, never even seen a live grenade before in his life, and therefore he flatly refused to carry out the corporal's order. Normally, of course, this would have entailed a close arrest situation where the man would have been confined in some manner, even though we were in the field. However, remembering my previous platoon sergeant's teachings, I decided that this was a case for careful consideration and not necessarily a strict disciplinary action. So I took the man to one side, and having satisfied him that I knew what I was about, I gave him a short introductory lesson to the grenade, and thereafter not only primed the grenade, but used them effectively that night.
Are there any signs or early signs or indications that you may have a man in a group that is likely to crack or give away or not go forward? Because obviously some men, it wasn't a question of so much of cowardice, it was just the pressure of ongoing pressure day in, day out of wearing them away.
I think I can recollect that this was a sort of situation which happened on a day-to-day basis. For instance, if we were a mobile, if it was a mobile situation, which we were, was often quite the case in Italy, in the mountain warfare areas, some days certain individuals would be on top of the job, and on other days they'd be down in the dumps, whilst the comrades on either side would be quite the opposite. And so I reckon that everybody being an individual person, and in any case, reacted in different ways as the different occasions came along. So, in any case, in my short-term service, in action anyway, I never saw anybody waver, and if they had, they'd been sharply edged along by the mates.
The comrades played a great part in keeping the unit together.
Yes, it's been said many times, and certainly well documented in various books, particularly David Ritchie's book, when Bernard Montgomery, the old general, praised the qualities of the Dunham battalions, particularly the family spirit which existed. And there's no doubt, as far as I'm concerned, that it's played a great part in not only maintaining the morale but steadying the men when things got tough.
You'd met a number of the enemy. What was the opinion that you formed of German troops?
Well, I never came to grips, literally speaking, with any Germans. Thank God, they're all twice as big as me at that time, in any case. I certainly know some of our chaps who did, and I'm glad to say most of them came off the best. But generally speaking, thinking about the results obtained by the German soldier, I can only say that I consider him to be one of the finest that there is, although it certainly was in those days. Of course, we do know that they had the rubbish at the back sometime. I think they were called the third line, the people who were usually put in charge of the immediate prisoner of war camps. But generally speaking, the German soldier, the front line soldier, up certainly to the middle, towards the end of the war, was a fine fighting character.
Were there any particular weapons that the Germans used which became to be feared by the troops?
Well, there were two, and this is a leading question, the most interesting one. We had, as people know, various types of mechanical guns, including the Bren gun, and the Sten gun in later years. The Germans had a much prized possession called the Schmeisser machine pistol, which had a folding handle and could be fired from the middle of the belly. Issued originally, I believe, to the parachute armies, but when in battle, certainly towards the end of one, everyone was looking for the opportunity to grab a German Schmeisser machine pistol. The main I was certainly interested in being a weapon training fiend. Its rate of fire was terrific, twice the cyclic rate of fire of a Thompson submachine gun, although the rounds were smaller calibre. Of course, on the debit side, the rate of fire was such that one had to carry that much ammunition on one's back, or comrades, or someone. So it must have given their supply people a bit of a headache. That's one of the weapons that I well remember, and a much prized piece of loot, I suppose, is a proper word. But the other one, and more feared, was of course the 88mm anti-flak gun, which could be fired in an anti-aircraft roll or on a ground roll at tanks. Latterly, it proved to be deadly accurate in the Normandy landings and later on in that battle.
Italian troops, what opinion did you form of those?
I haven't got any opinion of the Italian troops. to say the least. I mean, when people rise from the foxholes with four hands in the air, having been seriously challenged, it doesn't say much for the training, the background, the regimental history, or their attitude. Particularly when one, as we found as we did in the first attacks in the desert, that they put the poor bloody Libyan soldiers wearing a red fez in the front line, and they were at the back supposedly jockeying them up. I think the Italian soldier could be well compared with the type of equipment the Libyan soldiers wore. Rotten.
Did you gain much experience of booby traps that were being laid as you advanced?
Yes, a lot. This first started to be recognised at the much spoken of Sidi Barani place. One of the items of war which the Italians carried, their hand grenade, unlike ours, was not quite so heavy, painted a bright red, and consisted of a detachable cap, which flew off in the air, having thrown the grenade. And attached to the cap was a chain, which tore out a retaining pin as the grenade flew through the air. And on impact on the ground or against the wall, the grenade was supposed to explode. Well, on occasions, whether by accident or deliberation, these grenades would be found lying on the ground. And usually, any sudden disturbance would explode this missile, causing damage to one's foot, hand, or other part of the body.
Were there any other devices that was used?
Well, booby traps became the thing later on in North Africa. I never reached that point. Several of our people did, being attached to raiding columns further up towards Benghazi and even further on. And the Germans became adept at constructing and inventing mines and booby traps. A point I hadn't mentioned, during my stay with the 5th West York Train Battalion, I attended a mines and booby trap course at Ripon, which at that time was the School of Military Engineering. So although extensive in my knowledge was not put to great use, had I been in this theatre of war, I possibly would have managed to save a few lives. But devices were attached to the flushing systems in toilets. And when one had finished the one's necessary visit, having pulled the chain, his next of kin would have been informed. There were pressure devices placed under stones in wadis, which, of course, exploded when the sufficient weight was placed upon them. Anti-personnel mines and anti-tank mines are well featured in most war documentaries these days. And we respected, above all, the German anti-personnel mine called an S mine, S for shrapnel, was a piece of military precision engineering. This mine was this mine came as usually mines do, in three parts: as the body, the case, and the explosive device and tripping device. The mine was buried in the ground with a three-pronged arrangement, just showing above the surface, but not visible to the naked eye. Certainly not in the dark. And as the unsuspecting person trod upon this trip device, it would in turn set off the machinery inside the body of the mine, which projected the loose case into the air at a height of approximately 5 feet, and almost simultaneously explode, discharging some 500 ball bearings. Now, one shudders to think of the effect. I, as a stretcher bearer, saw some severe injuries caused by this bloody thing, and at this stage of the war, everyone became not only mine conscious but booby trap conscious. And just to close on this little incident, one of my stretcher bearer colleagues named Elliot, who comes from Hull, who I've since heard from, shortly after our arrival at Sidi Barani, was on an early morning trip to the cookout for a mug of tea when he saw this unknown object on the ground, and being a football fan, took a savage kick at it. neatly removing all his toes. This was one of these Italian red devils, as we used to call them.
Was it a method of fighting in warfare that men liked, or did they consider booby-trapping a rather dirty and unpleasant, unchivalrous business?
We thought it was, to coin a phrase, we thought it wasn't cricket. War's a dirty thing, we all agree about that. People shouldn't have to go around killing each other to satisfy politicians' whim. And I've changed my opinion about certain aspects of war cabinets, etc. But as far as laying deadly devices in toilets and under doormats and elsewhere, although it would have the desired effect as far as the enemy were concerned, it wasn't, according to our code of conduct, it wasn't quite the proper thing to do. We even had, and were constantly warned about these things, they were even known at one time to drop dummy fountain pens from the air. On second thoughts, we were bloody idiots to pick a fountain pen up in the middle of the desert, because obviously it hadn't been dropped from a W. Smith bloody lorry. But nevertheless, one was out in the desert and hadn't seen anything so sophisticated as a fountain pen in months. And so the gullible soldier, if not having second thoughts, would pick it up, and as he unscrewed the cap, it would blow up in his face. All sorts of these devices, even soap, was manufactured to contain the spring devices when the tablet of soap became wet. A chemical reaction would set in and blow up in your hands. I could go on for a long time about these things. I think that they were at this stage getting desperate, and everything they could do to at least slow us down, certainly in the advance along the North African coast, everything possible was done to hold us up.
Did it ever become our own policy to lay booby traps?
No. I honestly can say that it wasn't. Whilst I was with the 5th West Yorks, I was called upon to instruct on the neutralising and disarming of enemy-laid mines, and I did this, I hope, with good effect. We had retrained from light anti-aircraft duties lots of men to become soldiers, and infantry soldiers at that. They didn't take to this very kindly, but as I say, one of my main job for the best part of the 12 months I was with them was to teach them how to recognise, find, recognise and neutralise these terrible devices which the Boche had put in the ground and elsewhere.
Throughout the years that you were involved in warfare in the Second World War, did religion, personal religion, play any part in your character and personality and the way in which you were able to cope with things?
Well, I, as a boy, before I joined the army, certainly from the age of 12, went to Sunday school regularly and was introduced to this all these wonderful mysteries, and in even later years, before I left to start working as a young man, I was employed as the organ pumper at the local congregational church. So I not only knew all the hymns, I knew all the tunes, and I used to sing in unison with the organist, and what could have bloody noise that was too. But I never adopted religion as opposed to a true Christian. I attended Sunday school, and I had attended church on account of my organ pumping duties on a daily basis, morning and evening. Once I was into the army, I bloody well had to go to church. I was a bandsman, or trained to be a bandsman. We had an orchestra from the band which played it in the church service on a weekly basis again. And although at that time I wasn't sufficiently proficient to take part in this orchestra, the non-players were marched in and formed a so-called choir, which was much frowned upon by the rest of the troops, of course. When we went into battle, the padre, or padres, we sometimes had one or two different faiths, would hold regular outdoor services, and when we were in reserve, certainly there were drumhead services were held when possibly a whole brigade would be on parade, and so it was ever present that the ordinary man, I was almost saying, the man in the street, the man on the ground, was constantly reminded that there was such a thing as religion. But I think possibly half of our chaps, certainly in the Durham, didn't need reminding in any case, because we were dedicated Roman Catholics.